it may seem glamorous. It is not glamorous. Don't get me wrong. There's lots of wonderful things about it. But all these things, building an enduring company, doing it in environments that are changing, you know, rapidly, being responsible for thousands of employees, it's a hard thing, but it's worthwhile doing hard things. Like raising kids is a hard thing. Being a good partner is a hard thing. Like the most worthwhile things we do are pretty hard things. But if we do them well, the amount of impact plus the amount of reward is just so outsized.
Hi, I'm Jubin, operating partner at Kleiner Perkins, and I'm excited that you're tuning into Grit. The goal of this is not for it to be a highlight reel of how successful my guests are, rather a candid exploration of how hard it is, both personally and professionally, to create, build, and scale world-class organizations. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe, leave a review, and make sure to follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter. Thanks.
Have you been here before?
I haven't. Okay. I haven't.
Okay. Well, welcome.
It's a great location.
Where are you?
We're just a couple blocks away. We're on 633 Folsom. So it was a lovely walk on a lovely day.
It is a nice day.
Yeah.
Do you come in every day?
So Asana is what we call office-centric hybrid. So we come in Monday, Tuesday, Thursday. Wednesdays, we generally try to keep that no meeting Wednesdays. So most people work from home, though we have a core contingent that comes in because it's a nice office.
How good are you about, honestly, about keeping Wednesdays free?
It depends on the team. Customer-facing teams all have, you know, external meetings, but we really try to protect that for product, design, engineering, so people have flow time uninterrupted. And then we keep Fridays flexible depending on, we let people use their judgment with their managers on if there's something to come in for, they should come in, but if there's not, then they can choose to work from home.
Wasn't Dustin and you all like pretty early on the beat during COVID of creating the flexible, I guess, hybrid policy that you have now?
We were. And that came from a lot of research on collaboration and productivity and our belief that people coming together at the same time kind of creates better innovation, especially at our stage and size.
Like, I think he got some flack for it, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. It was definitely very controversial.
It was. Were you there at that point?
I was on the board at the time and then joined while all these discussions were still going on.
Yeah.
And it was because so many companies had said, we are permanently remote, work from anywhere, anytime. And I think we had, you know, with Dustin's leadership, a strong thesis of, one, if you were like, anybody can choose whatever to come back or not to come back, it would degrade to the lowest common denominator, which is the people who made the effort to come in would spend most of their time on Zoom collaborating with the people who didn't come in. And then they'd be like, why did I come in? Which I think has proven out for a lot of places that are now encouraging people to come back in on the same days.
Totally.
And a lot of it was also based on like where we are, were in where the company is and growth and the kinds of teams we were building. You know, it affected different people in different ways. There were employees who knew what it was like, the sauna culture to be together. So I think for a lot of those employees, it was like, oh, I know what that feels like. And when we can come back together, I want that feeling again. Mm-hmm. I think the hardest group was people we hired during the pandemic, where all they experienced
was remote.
Yeah. And so that did feel like a big change.
Yeah.
And we created a lot of flexibility as people were transitioning back. And then there's a group of employees as we came back where we were very specific, this is our policy. And they're like, great, I was actually looking for a place where I could come in. And I do think we've now settled into a really good rhythm. And the days people are in, it's awesome, you know?
Oh, yeah. Have you ever seen one of my investors was just asking me about if I've ever seen precedent for a company around Series A or B who is remote as a company at that point that then creates a full in-person culture. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, I don't know if I've seen that.
I couldn't come up with a single example.
I can't think of one either. I feel like it's more the opposite, which is as they grow and trying to acquire talent and wanting to provide
become
flexibility.
More distributed.
Yeah. It'd be so fascinating.
I would love to learn because the challenge is the genie's out of the bottle at some point, right? Again, similar to COVID, when everyone distributed and companies made a stake in the ground that we are now a distributed company, remote moving forward, it's very hard. Yeah. And be like, actually, just kidding. Yeah. I mean, I just saw an announcement today. Dell said everybody's back in the, like, it's just hard.
Yeah.
It's very hard.
With the startups, I also wonder how much it is, like, if the founding team and different people in different roles are actually physically in different cities, it would make it harder to then say, hey, we're all coming together. Because then you'd have to pick a location.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah.
I was with Scott McNeely yesterday. Do you know who Scott McNeely is?
I do.
What an eclectic character. And one of the things that he said to me that made me think of you in this conversation today is that at some point, Sun got to be 40,000 employees and the stock price went from the moon down and then it climbed back up and it has a mind of its own, as you know. And he said, there's only so much managing as a public company that I felt like I could do. Eventually, people tend to just manage to the stock price. That's what he thought. And I thought, you know, given what Asana has seen, which was incredible growth, gangbuster growth during COVID, and then a dramatic fall down, call it like 80 to 90% fall down from the peak of COVID. And again, this is not in the business. This is just the stock price. I just wonder how that resonates with you. Like, that's just got to be a emotional challenge.
To me, the emotional part of the challenge is more looking out for our employees and helping them along the journey.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Because they're all thinking about all the things that you would normally think about when a stock price goes up and down.
Absolutely. And it affects their life and their plans and their hopes and their dreams. We take that responsibility really seriously. And there are a couple things recently. One is just remembering where people are in their career, what they've seen or not seen. And there's a number of us on the leadership team. We were having this all hands. And our amazing CFO and I were answering questions. And he was saying to the team, okay, everybody, remember the dot-com boom and bust. Remember what happened in 2008, 2009 to technology. And just enduring businesses are built actually during these downturns, the ones with grit and long-term vision and being able to weather these. And those are all true. And Tim and I are up there and I said, Tim, we just got to take a moment and remember where people from our employee base were in 2000 or 2008 and 9. Like, some of them were still in grade school, you know, like they weren't in these tech environments. And it was just a moment of like, okay, to them, so much of this is like history lessons, not lived experiences. And so it's our responsibility as leaders and managers, not necessarily tell them like, hey, everything's going to be okay, but actually to focus on the things of, hey, how do you build resilience? How do you see this now as an opportunity? How do you see this as an opportunity to build really meaningful skills, both professionally and personally? And I think that's what we focus on, plus delivering for our customers, building an enduring business that doesn't make the ups and downs of the stock price not part of the equation, but it helps to focus everybody on the things that are controllable.
Yeah. It does help explain away why people want to stay private for longer in some respect, right? Because there's just less distractions. Call it what you want. It's still a distraction. Don't you think? Or do you disagree with me? You're giving me the looks of disagreement. Please.
No, I'm giving you the look of like I'm pondering that. I think I see it more as it's an added responsibility. How we handle it is whether we see it as a distraction or not. But to me, being a public company is just an added level of responsibility to shareholders, to employees who are also shareholders, and to how we run the business. If we allow it to be a distraction, it's a distraction, versus if we do a good job setting context on how to think about earnings, how to think about setting targets, how to think about delivering on our commitments, it's an opportunity.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Can I tell you an observation that I had from the first time that we chatted?
Sure.
And then something that has also struck me in all the other interviews that I've watched of you, which is when somebody asks you a question, and I have a feeling this is not just in podcast format. When somebody asks a question, you don't immediately respond. You actually, like, I can see your brain processing the question. And I think that's a weird observation because everyone's probably like, well, duh, like, of course. But most people don't do that. They're eager to hear the question out so that they can immediately come back with an answer. Even now, in that last question, the eyes that you were giving me were the processing eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you always been this way? First of all, do you agree with that observation? Has anybody else told you this thing that you do?
No one's told it to me exactly how you've shared it. So I
sloppily and
no, yeah. Oh my gosh, no. I found that very thoughtful of like, oh, huh, that's a great insightful observation.
It's almost professorial.
Oh, okay. I can see that. Yeah. I've spent some time teaching, so that might contribute to that. But you had a good question of have I always been this way? I actually credit it way back to, you know, I started my career as a product manager. And so that skill set of being curious and asking good questions and knowing how to ask generative questions when you're really trying to understand a problem. Like I think being good at asking questions and listening to the question are ways that we connect as humans. When I pause to listen to a question, it's often because I'm trying to take a step back and think about, oh, what is someone trying to understand from me? Or what's a good way to be clear about how to answer that and make sure I'm actually connecting on a human level versus, oh, I'm making some kind of assumption and I'm going to give you a pre-prescribed answer, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I imagine it makes people really feel acknowledged.
I hope so, or heard, or understood.
Were you like this younger, pre-work too? Is your mom or dad like this?
Both my parents are teachers, or have spent time teaching, and I'm a middle child of three girls, so did a lot of peacemaking in my role as the middle sister. And then, if you're familiar with Myers-Briggs, mm-hmm. I am an INFJ. Which I sometimes jokingly say, really, I miss my calling as a therapist. I just play one in the work setting.
Nice.
Another way I would describe it, a good friend of mine that was part of the founding team at Blue Nile, which was one of my early career journeys, at one point he said to me, first of all, are you a Trekkie? Have you?
Star Trek?
New generation.
No.
Well, for those who are, there's a character on the program who is the ship's counselor, and she is a Betazoid. It's like half human, half Betazoid. And Betazoids are empaths. They can just look at you and feel your feelings. My friend and colleague Ben, like, we were having a whole series of conversations, you know, talking about the team. And then he paused and he was like, Anne, I have something to tell you. And I was like, okay. And he said, you're a Betazoid. And I was like, I think that's like one of the nicest things you could say. Like, you're an empath. And I care about making that connection and understanding where someone's coming from.
What was conversation like at the dinner table for you growing up? Was it chaotic? Was it like you and the three sisters throwing food at each other?
Oh, no. We are not a chaotic family. So my mom and dad were both born in China and then emigrated to Taiwan post-Cultural Revolution. So grew up in Taipei and then came out to the United States for grad school. So it's a very common immigrant story of that generation, and especially for Chinese Americans. And so my dad got his PhD in chemistry and then found his way into technology, worked for GE and then IBM in research, and spent the last significant part of his career actually in a research lab on artificial intelligence. I share that because, like, my dad is like a very structured, thoughtful thinker, very intentional in his communications. My mom, for a long time, was a stay-at-home parent. And then later on, as my sisters and I were headed towards college, built a fabulous career for herself as a mortgage broker, of all things. She was just like, I'm going to go out, get a job, and I'm going to be amazing at it. So our family dinner tables were more, I think, like, structured and thoughtful and very supportive, but not chaotic.
I think you just said it, what I was trying to say, which is intentional communicator. That's how I feel like you are, a very intentional communicator. And I bet it serves you incredibly well in your work. When was the last time you regretted saying something? Do you even experience that?
I probably experienced more regretting not saying something or regretting that I didn't say it in a way that was constructive or like led to a better outcome versus regretting saying something because I hadn't thought about the word choice. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Can you expand on regretting not saying something? What would be an example of that?
I think the regrets on not saying something or not saying something in potentially a more direct way comes from how to give feedback and how to know when and how to give feedback when it's constructive. And there are times where it's not so much as I'm holding back as much as I'm thinking about, like, is this the right moment? Am I showing enough care to this other person? And so I will find myself waiting or pausing because when we have the conversation, I want it to be productive. And there's times when I manage a growing team with lots of opportunities and challenges that there's times when I think, oh, I should have been okay in the moment having it be a little messier versus like expecting myself to do it in a way that was
structured.
Yes.
Can you give me an example?
Oh, I have so many.
What's one that comes to mind?
The ones that come to mind are always with leaders on the team, because leaders, I really believe, have an outsized impact on their team, on people who work for the people that work for them, right? Leaders can shine a light, they can cast a shadow, and so they have an outsized impact. And so the ones where I look back on and say, hey, did I do enough fast enough in terms of my communication, are almost always the ones that involve leaders, where I tend to want to give people a lot of trust. Like if we've done a good job bringing a great leader on, I want to give them a lot of empowerment and trust and not get in their way. I think balancing that empowerment with, oh, if something is happening, am I course correcting with them fast enough? I think are always the examples that come to mind of like, could I have done something earlier? Could I have given feedback earlier? Could we, if they're not quite on track, am I doing enough?
So you're saying you think you should put more structure or less structure? It seems to me that your default state is structure.
In my communication, yeah.
In your communication. But when you manage, your default state is less structure.
Empowerment, yes.
Hmm. You said leaders have the ability to shine a light or cast a shadow.
Yeah.
Can you double click on that second part of casting a shadow? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, what I mean by that is what I've seen throughout my career and what I see at Asana every day is how a leader shows up in a meeting, in an interaction, in how they communicate something. It just has an outsized impact. People respond to that. They're looking at that for signal, right? They're looking at that for signal on, are we doing the right thing? Am I doing the right thing? Are we going to be successful? Are we confident in what we're doing? As well as the opposite. Oh, does this person seem stressed and worried? Are they distracted? Is there something I'm supposed to read from that? Is there something else going on? Right. Or another way to say it is I always remind, and this was part of lots of conversations during the growth period at Zendesk when I was there, which is just a reminder to the leadership team that we always have more information, more context, more power over our teams than we sometimes realize. And so how we show up, do we show up confident? Do we show up transparent? Do we show up constructive? Are we helping people see where we're going? If we're not doing that, we can have, whether intentional or not intentional, a side effect, which is that we cast a shadow and people are worried and they're stressed and they're feeling the negative vibes. And that can have just cascading effects in an organization, especially when times are tough or uncertain. And so that's really what I mean by like, you can shine a light or you can cast a shadow. It's a choice. It's a choice all of us have in every instance on like how we show up.
When you came to Stanford from Taiwan?
I grew up in the Bay Area. Yeah. So
Okay. You grew up in the Bay.
I did.
Your parents came here.
They came here. They landed briefly in the East Coast, but I have been a Bay Area native since kindergarten.
Grew up in the Bay.
Yeah.
What struck me about your work history until probably Zendesk.
Yeah.
Is that you didn't stay at basically any company for more than 3 years. Maybe that's wrong. Okay, eBay 5 years. eBay 5 years. But there is a lot of experiences before and after that. Yeah. That are all...
You're trying to tell me I was a millennial before it was popular to be an MLM.
I was trying to say you're... For someone as thoughtful, as intentional as you are,
yeah.
I don't think that you took these decisions lightly at all. It was just an interesting observation to have 2 years at Bain, 2 years at Gymboree, a year or two at Icarian, a year or two at Blue Nile, then 5 years at eBay, a year at Zazzle, a year at Insider Pages, 3 years at Business, and then 2 years at SurveyMonkey, start your own company, 2 years, sell it to TaskRabbit. When you reflect back on all of this, which I'm sure you have, what do you attribute that to?
Each one, I think, has a unique set of circumstances. But a common theme for a long time in my career is I was a startup person and I love the startup building phase. I credit the Blue Nile experience. I mean, we were a group of ex-Bain consultants that during the dot-com boom decided, Mark and Ben, who started a company, like decided like, oh, this is a good time to figure out how to sell diamonds online. I mean, I just graduated from business school. My husband and I, you know, went to tell our parents, we have news. And both sets of parents thought our news was that we were having a baby. And our news was, we're moving to Seattle so Anne can join a startup and sell diamonds online. In that conversation, my mom still was like, well, what about the baby? And I was like, there's not a baby. We're just moving to Seattle to sell diamonds online.
No.
Yeah. There's a baby in the story. And so we did, you know, deliver for the grandparents. But the reason, you know, our news was not you're becoming grandparents. Our news was like, oh, there's this like super cool high risk opportunity, but it sounds like a good thing to do. And it's a group of people I had worked with at Bain. That experience of coming together with a group of people, having what a lot of people thought was a crazy idea, and then just figuring out how to build it and delivering for customers was just like very formative.
And sorry, can I pause you there?
Yeah, sure.
How long did that last?
I was there for 2 years. And then as the bubble was
bursting,
Mark, who is the founder and CEO, very insightfully, he actually saw it before a lot of the dot-com companies went out of business. And he had the insight and the foresight to say, we're going to pull back on costs. We're going to do everything we could weather this storm because we don't know how long that's going to last. And that actually just means everything is going to change. Like people's jobs are going to change. We're not going to be building as much. And then at the same time that was happening, my husband and I, we had a baby. And for family reasons, we just wanted to be closer to family in the Bay Area. My mother-in-law at the time had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and we just wanted to be closer to her as she was going through all of her treatments. And so that's when I joined eBay, which at the time was like a little under 2,000 people. And by the time I left was over 10,000, which was also just such an incredible...
Was Chatwani there?
Yeah. Chatwani is there. Yes. I love Mr. Chatwani.
He's amazing.
There were so many great people in that era. I remember sitting on a conference room floor when Jeff Jordan told us we had bought PayPal. There are just so many memories I have of that run at eBay and the incredible people that were there at that time. So each of them had probably a combination of both like professional and personal, but for quite a while, I loved the early stage build, which comes with risk, and a number of them definitely turned out differently than maybe when I thought I joined, but it did help me figure out over time the things that matter in deciding on a role, like what to go to as well as what to leave.
I want to get there in a second.
Yeah.
But after going to these early stage startups, right? You do one, doesn't go well. You do another, goes under. You do another after eBay, it's okay. I guess, are people around you, your family, not being like, hey, why don't you get like, you know, a stable, like your husband? I don't know. Even you, is the voice in Anne's head not saying like, is this, what's up with that?
Yeah. Well, one, my husband is the best person ever and super supportive. So I think he's always been like, you decide what do you think is best. What will make you happy? Will you enjoy spending your time on? So he is absolutely the best in all of this. Did people have questions? Yeah, sure. And at the same time, I have a great family. And I think people in the end are, at least the people around me, have always been supportive in wanting me to be happy and feel fulfilled versus like, oh, there's a prescribed thing you're supposed to do to be quote unquote successful. And I appreciate that. I wish that for everybody, that they have people who aren't judging them or evaluating success based on the outside and encouraging them to invest on their inside, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And when did you have the kid?
I had three of them.
When was number one?
Yeah. So my oldest son was born in Seattle. We had the baby.
Okay.
We had the baby. And actually having the baby was probably the best thing ever. Well, for so many reasons, including I think it helped me become less of a perfectionist and happy to share more. Like I encourage people who are, I call myself a recovering perfectionist. The more children I have had, the more that has become easier to let go of the things that are less important. But I have three kids. So my oldest son was born in Seattle. My daughter was born when I was at eBay. I was actually one of the very few people who had kids in that era. I sometimes joke, though, that it was harder to have a child at eBay than it was at a startup. Because at a startup, there's only so many humans, you know, it's a startup, it's a small team, everyone knows each other, everyone was super supportive, people saw my child as like their child, it was, the people were wonderful. At eBay, we were just this rocket ship growing, you know, I ran a big product team kind of in the middle of the organization, so like my schedule and choices were not always my own.
You were getting pulled on both directions.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so...
And you're saying you were unique to have kids at that point there?
Yeah, there weren't that many women in leadership positions that had children. I was doing performance reviews for my team on the way into the hospital when I was having my daughter.
Come on.
No, I was. Because I was like, one, I'm responsible for all these people. Two, who's going to do their performance reviews?
Wait, while you're going to the hospital?
Yeah, while I was going, my husband was driving and I was finishing my performance reviews. And then I brought my daughter into the office a couple of weeks after to deliver some of the performance reviews. Because I cared about my team a lot. I wanted them to get the feedback from me. And then my youngest was born right as we were selling Insider Pages to IAC. So that was a fun time. I actually, like, during the deal negotiations, I was starting to show, but not really. And we were so worried, or I was so worried, that they weren't going to acquire a startup if they knew someone on the leadership team was going to go out on maternity leave. And in a very small world fashion, the person running the deal for IAC was a GSB alum and had connections, and she pulled me aside during one of the due diligence sessions. And these are just like those memorable things in your life and your career where she was like, it's okay, we're going to be fine. And you shouldn't have to worry about like hiding being pregnant. And so that was a very lovely thing to, meant a lot to me. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And so those are always like the pass it forward moments where it's like, oh, someone did something extra kind. How can I make sure I hold that with me and do that for other people?
Do you feel a pressure to perform?
Oh, every day, all the time. Constant.
Can you describe that feeling?
For me, the pressure is, am I doing enough for all the people I'm responsible for? And so that's the pressure I carry with me. Am I being clear enough? Am I giving enough context? Am I thoughtful about my decisions and know the impact that that has on the employees that are on the teams that I ultimately empower? So that's the pressure. It's certainly like an internal one of like, am I doing my best? Is my bar high enough?
But don't you think that pressure probably existed when you were at Bain as a IC consultant too?
Oh, sure. I was raised to always know that there was something better, that I could do better in a good way.
Meaning you feel pressure to maybe achieve some future potential of yourself.
Yeah, or a different way I say it now, right? That kind of pressure growing up was different than the kind of pressure now. I think ultimately the source of the pressure for me is I have a lot of privilege. I have a lot of privilege and choice of how I spend my time, the resources available to me? And am I doing enough with that privilege? Because the privileges I have, I'm well aware, are not options or opportunities for the vast majority of humans on this planet. And so that's responsibility, I think, as much as it is privilege. And so that, to me, is my source of pressure, is am I doing the most with the opportunities I have and making as positive an impact as I can?
You always feel pressure?
Pretty much. Okay, when I'm curled up with a good book, I don't feel pressure.
But outside of that?
Yeah, I do feel responsibility.
What does it feel like? Like ants in your pants to like get moving?
I don't think I'm like a frenetic person.
How does the pressure manifest?
The pressure manifests more in self-reflection. Not so much self-criticism, but self-reflection of like a situation happens and then I will go to a place of, okay, if I unpack that, did I do the best I could have? And if I decide that I didn't and there's an opportunity to do better, then I try to find an opportunity to course correct as soon as possible.
Yeah. I think my pressure comes from the same place that yours does, which is pushing, right?
Yeah.
Pushing myself to be a great version of who I could
yeah.
be. But I think it comes, if I go backwards, there's definitely judgment. Like nobody judges Jubin as good as he judges himself, you know? And then if I look, if there's pressure forwards into the future, that pressure manifests with ants in my pants. It turns into action very quickly. Otherwise, I have found that that feeling will eat me alive, if that makes sense. Almost like I'd be too scared to ruminate for too long on the feeling of the pressure, because then it's like I'm not doing enough about it.
Yeah, it's your way of like channeling that energy in a positive
form. Does that make sense?
It does. I also think the part you said about no one sets the bar for you but you is actually very liberating. And I think I find the people who enjoy what they do and perform the best at what they do are wired that way. Because once you determine how high the bar is and you're the one that's always resetting where that bar is, it matters less what other people think, because generally these top performers, their bar is higher than what anybody else can set for them. And therefore they respond to feedback so differently. They seek feedback. They're always the first to come and want more feedback, more critical feedback, and they can take it in a way that they can act on. So having managed so many people and having gotten to work with so many people at so many different places throughout my career, I think that's been a sort of constant thread on the people who consistently perform well in many, many different situations. It's because they've decided to set the bar wherever they want.
But let's assume you're that person as well. Do you feel like it ever comes from a place that you're not enough? Meaning, don't you think the other side of the coin very easily of achievement is this insecurity of not doing enough?
Yeah, I'm laughing because way back when we rewind, way back early in my career, so I was a Bain AC after undergrad, and in a moment of transparency, the head recruiter for Bain at the time in our office said, you know what the secret is to finding great Bain ACs? Insecure overachievers. And then when she said that, I was like, oh, that's maybe a very accurate description of all of us. So
AC is a
associate consultant. Yeah. It's like sort of the most junior consultant. Yeah. I would say that described me for a stretch of time in my life and career. And then when I said I'm a recovering perfectionist, I do think for me, having kids changed that. It just changed the equation. Becoming a parent, all of a sudden, at least for me, is like, I'm clearly not the most important person anymore, by far. Now my responsibility is to this little human and then three of them to make sure they are thriving in this world. And it's the something bigger than yourself, something more important. And it, for me, that sort of shifted the equation of the insecurity. I think it just shifted the focus and priorities much more to, am I raising good humans? Am I providing an environment where they can be their best selves. And so I think for me, becoming a mom was the best thing that could have ever happened to me just as a person, period. But certainly also as a manager, a boss, a professional.
What did it allow you to relinquish?
It allowed me to prioritize much better and be much clearer about what matters and what doesn't matter. Because there's this whole set of other responsibilities and care and humans that clearly matter. And those humans actually could care less what my job is or what my title is. You know, especially when kids are young, all they want is like your time and attention and love. And so that ability to shift and know in the moment, am I 100% there for them? I share this all the time with people on my team who are going through either having their first child or their second or just transitions in their life of the most important thing I think we can all learn is to be where we are in the moment. If you're home, be home. If you're at work, be at work. The times when we are the most stressed out is when we're in one place thinking about the other. We're not living in the moment either with our family or our child or our parent or our partner. And then if we're at work distracted by what's happening at home, then we're not present for our team, for our customer. It's easier said than done, but that is a practice I've worked on a lot in my life and career is just, am I in the moment? And in the moment, am I the best version of myself I can be?
How do you work on that?
It's first recognizing when I'm not. And then inspecting that and thinking, well, what created that? What allowed me or caused me to be distracted in that particular situation? And is there something I could have done to shift? You know, is there something I could have done to say, yes, there's a bunch of stuff that is stressful at work. And how might I just process it and then leave it where it is, knowing that it's still going to be there? And then how do I, in this moment, be here for a child, my partner, a parent, and really listen deeply to what's going on with them.
Did having number one, I don't know the names of your kids, so I'm just going to put them in order. I'm just going to put them in order of one, two, three. Did it change your risk calculus than having gone and spent 5 years at eBay?
It had not necessarily changed. Like I didn't join eBay necessarily because like, oh, I have a child now and eBay
is secure.
Yeah, because in that era, like eBay wasn't, not that it wasn't secure. It was already a public company and it was growing. But back to the conversation I had with my parents where it was like, hey, I'm going to sell diamonds online. eBay in that era was like lots of collectibles. It was like, oh, now I'm going to go work for an online auction where a lot of Beanie Babies are sold. So it was the beginning of like all of this like commerce and the internet and like, are people going to buy and sell things? So it still came, I think, versus like traditional stable careers, I think it still came with a certain amount of risk. But in terms of the calculation, once I had kids, I actually think even more so it was, hey, if I'm going to make the explicit choice to spend time somewhere else, not raising my kids, then am I making those choices well? And that process, I would say, has evolved of really distilling down to like, hey, what matters in an opportunity for me that then like I really feel like I'm putting my whole self in there and time and talent is worthwhile spending versus like spending that time. My kids are older now, but like in that era, like raising my children.
Did you question whether that was the right way to allocate your time? Meaning, you know, just listening to you, like your mother spent the time raising the kids.
Yeah.
And then once you were out of the house, she went back to work.
Right.
Which is interesting. Like, was there even a decision in your mind?
Well, it was more a joint decision with my husband. So my husband was the stay-at-home parent with our kids. And he's now a water polo swim coach. So not in tech, which is actually a nice
refreshing
balance. Yeah, absolutely. And that actually afforded me the opportunity to do and try all these different things because I had a great partner who was spending all that quality time with our kids.
Yeah, that makes sense. Why'd you start a company? You decided, I'm not risk on enough. So I want to
What led to that?
Actually, the story behind that is I was on the board of a company called ThreadUp, and the team there was incubating an idea that was different than the core business. And it was so interesting as we were talking about that idea, but it was a different set of resources and a different value proposition. And the team there at the time was thinking about spinning it out or doing something different with it. And I just really fell in love with the idea and thought, hey, if we're going to spin it out, if someone's going to do this, I raised my hand and said, like, I actually would love to give it a go. That was how that came about.
Wow. And SurveyMonkey, the job that you were leaving as a VP at the time, was a legit company.
Oh, totally. And I had the great privilege of working with Dave Goldberg, who's one of the most amazing people on the planet, who I miss dearly. So absolutely, it was a big decision. And he was incredibly supportive. He was the first person to be like, of course you got to go try something. Everybody has to go try something.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So sad.
Yeah, I miss him all the time and everybody who he touched. He was the first leader I ever worked for who came by my desk one night and was like, why are you still here? Your kids are at home. They're only going to be awake for so long. You should see them and spend time with them. And then the rest of the stuff is going to be here. And he modeled it. He left the office to be with his kids. So that, again, that's one of those pay it forward. So I try to do that for my team. Just remind them that the work is still going to be there. But, you know, especially little kids are only awake for certain fixed hours in the day. So you got to see them.
Wow. And so you have this great job, great boss.
Yeah. Yeah. You're asking me the question, were you nuts or something?
Yeah. Without saying it. Yes. Yeah.
It's okay. Yeah. I feel like we're friends now. You can ask me those.
Trust me, I'm my own version of nuts. So it resonates.
It was a little bit nutty, but I think
like
I
you were making a lot of money, right? I mean, like you had a good salary.
Totally.
Like,
and it was a great business and it was growing and I loved the team. I think it was much more. So it came to like, oh, do I believe in the purpose? Is this like an interesting problem to solve? Do I think I'll learn a lot and make an impact? And then in this case, especially in forming a team, like, is it with a bunch of great people? And is it a good learning opportunity? If anything, I think that opportunity taught me a number of things. One, it is a scary thing to do. It can be a lonely thing to do to found something. So you've got to have good people around you. It helped me develop tremendous, tremendous empathy for founders. And also realize in myself, I'm a good partner to a founder. I might not be the best sort of founder on my own for lots of different reasons. And so
Can you articulate those reasons?
It comes back to maybe the thread is back to like the pressure. Like I just felt a tremendous amount of pressure to like make it all work for the people that we had talked out of other great paying jobs to go try something. I think I also learned a lot about how do you really iterate as quickly as you can on an idea to figure out if there's product market fit? How do you fully understand the customer need? I learned a lot about how to capitalize or not capitalize a business. It was one that had inventory, which even further burns the amount of cash that you've raised. I learned about myself of, hey, with all that amount of pressure, I don't know that I'm at my best and using the skills and talents where I feel like I'm strongest. I do feel like I'm a good partner to a founder.
Why?
Back to the Betazoid empathy traits that I have, I think I can hopefully be like a better sounding board, someone who sees the other things going on and then can support someone's, their genius and creativity. I thrive in that environment.
What did you feel like you lacked? Like you went to the pressure first.
Yeah.
What's the difference in the pressure between those two things?
I think the difference in the pressure between those two roles is a certain amount of objectivity.
What do you mean?
That as the partner to someone who is a founder, and whether that's in my role now or whether I was in a similar role at Zendesk, even in some of my board roles, is I think I can bring a combination of knowing what the visceral feelings are of like trying to create something that hasn't been created and put it out in the world and the pressures of making that all work and is it going to be successful or not, with then the people and team skills that I've developed through all my experiences, and bring a balance and a partnership that I'm happy in that role. Yeah. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And did TaskRabbit end up just acqui-hiring the business?
Yeah. And the team.
And the team, everybody.
Yeah.
And you spent a year there? Not even?
Yeah. Yep.
As the CRO. Then you go to Zendesk. You're early.
Yeah. It was private at the time.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was a fun experience.
And Amanda was there.
Amanda is my best friend. Yes. I love Amanda.
Clayhot, she is?
Yes.
No, she's not.
Yes, she is.
Amanda, you hear that? No way.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Amanda, you're my best friend.
What the hell? If if I had known that,
yeah,
I wouldn't have spent, I don't know, 2 years trying to get this freaking podcast recorded. I would have just gone to her and said, hey, I would have phoned a friend and had her reach out on my behalf to you.
Wait, that's feedback for me. Did I feel like hard to reach?
You're very hard to schedule with.
Okay. I'm sorry about that. Yeah. Amanda is absolutely my best friend. Like, I cannot do what I do without Amanda.
I don't know, COO basically of Figma.
Yes. Yes.
I just talked to her for a while. She's living the good life right now.
Yes, in Moab. It's beautiful.
Have you gone out there and visited her?
No, but I want to. But yeah, back to like, hey, things that are important on these journeys, especially the ups and downs, like have a best friend like Amanda Clea. And yeah, it makes it all so much better, especially being able to talk to somebody who, you know, we can range the topics from hiring and feedback for the team and decision making, partnering with a brilliant founder, to PLG motions, tests that we're running, to just all the things. So
I was with a COO yesterday for lunch. And mm-hmm. one of the questions that I asked him, again, you were on my mind, was these founders, let's say Dylan Field, the Figma founder, or Dustin, the Asana founder, formerly Facebook founder. These are incredible visionaries. John Doerr has a definition for a great founder, which is the ability to pull the future into the present. And I would describe both of them in this category of having this incredible vision. And I think the reflection that I was having with the COO that I was talking to the other day was, so many of our portfolio companies want someone like you in the seat. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult when you have this archetype of founder, because your job in a lot of ways is to help that vision come to life. But in other ways, it's to be therapist and coach. And in other ways, it's to be the only person in the room at times that will give it to the founder straight and directly. And underneath all of that, there is a certain, I don't know if deferentialness is the right word, but like, it is the founder's vision that ultimately the entire company is moving in that direction. It's your job to be the API between that vision and what the company is trying to do. Anyway, less of a question, but more just kind of like, yeah, what do you make of that?
I think that's such an apt description. And I think when you said the word deferential, I think of it more as...
I didn't mean that negatively.
Okay. Yeah, no.
Did you feel that negatively?
I didn't feel it negatively. I think it made me think about like, what are all the feelings or what are all the elements? And to me, it's just this, really just this tremendous amount of respect and back to feeling very privileged to have the opportunity to be a part of building Asana, to be a part of really fulfilling this vision and mission that
and what Dustin is that? Had. What is it? What is
yeah,
the vision?
It's to help humanity thrive by making it more effortless for teams to work together of all sizes. I mean, that's a big, powerful mission and a desire to solve a problem with technology that can really unlock human potential. There's no one, I think, that we talk to at any size company, any size team, that's like, Yep, we figured out how to be a high functioning team all the time. And I think Dustin experienced that with JR, co-founder, just so viscerally when they were scaling and building Facebook that they felt like this is a bigger, more impactful problem to solve for humanity. And it's a gift that they are wanting to put out in the world. And so for me, I feel like that's the ultimate privilege to be a part of that. And then back to the pressure, it's like, am I doing enough? Am I doing it well enough to make sure things are moving positively in the right direction?
It is a really hard job, though. There's a reason it's so important and powerful, but founders are a special breed of person, aren't they? This is a unique individual.
Yeah, they are.
Generally speaking, off the Richter scale on a few things in both directions. Would that also be fair to say? It's very rare that from what I've seen that a founder is, if you were going back to your ENTJ that they're right in the middle, they're probably spiking on some of those
Myers-Briggs, I'm sure.
And so you have to shock absorb in a lot of cases, some of those extremes, right?
Yeah. See, all these threads connect back. That makes sense. Me as an empath, I'm wired to not only do that, but I think enjoy that and feel that it's fulfilling. And back to the founders are, like, I have had the great privilege of working with some incredible founders. And then for me, it's also incredible founders that are absolutely kind human beings that really are driven by doing good in the world and being a good person. It's fun to be around people that have a vision but are also geniuses. Just the ability to riff on ideas or have discussions and debates and also see them. I loved that description of see them pull the future into the present. Just see them put out into the world something that didn't exist before and have people rally around that. It's a powerful experience that I wish more people had because it tells us all the possibilities of what people can do.
Yeah, I think that's well said. This is a weird question, but do you think that people think you have a cushier job than you do?
Oh, I don't know.
Like on your LinkedIn, you know, your kids' parents, they all see the the logo and the title. And
they're like, gosh, she's just living the life.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Do you ever feel that way?
Yeah, I do.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I think I more jokingly tell people, like, it may seem glamorous. It is not glamorous. Don't get me wrong. There's lots of wonderful things about it. But all these things, building an enduring company, doing it in environments that are changing, you know, rapidly, being responsible for thousands of employees, it's a hard thing, but it's worthwhile doing hard things. Like raising kids is a hard thing. Being a good partner is a hard thing. Like the most worthwhile things we do are pretty hard things. But if we do them well, the amount of impact plus the amount of reward is just so outsized. Maybe I'll just say, like, in a world that there's so many sound bites and like we're attracted to things that seem like they're fast and easy, I think people can over anchor on the perception of, oh, that seems fun and successful. And it's not that I'm trying to dissuade them from pursuing that, but it's wanting to be pragmatic and setting people's expectations of like, yes, there's many wonderful things and it takes a lot of time, energy, and effort, and commitment, and hard work, and willingness to deal with the messy stuff to have it be successful and fulfilling.
Yeah, it's like a tax.
Yeah.
You gotta pay the tax.
Yeah.
They pulled you off the board of Asana. Dustin, you were on the board first of Asana, correct?
I was the first independent director. So as the business was growing and the company was planning further out to go public, and it's a common thing to then start bringing operators on. It joined when the company was private, and then we were building out our board to go public. And then our former COO picked his head up after an incredible run and was going to take some time off and retire. And he and Dustin and our head of people reached out and said, hey, you know us and the business so well and the team. Would you consider coming back to operating? And I I really feel like there were very few jobs. I mean, knowing how hard operating is and knowing...
You were not working full time in a role.
No, I had moved into like teaching at Stanford Business School. I was joining boards. I was starting to think about like, oh, is there like a portfolio of stuff that I want to do? And then...
Consulting, going into venture.
Yeah, all those.
Doing the dark side stuff. Yeah, I know it.
It's not the dark side. Uh-huh. There's wonderful people doing it. And then I was like, hey, do I want to? Knowing all I know about operating, do I want to? And I love this problem that we're solving. I love the people that are doing it. I felt like my experiences could make an impact in a meaningful way. And I actually, to be super honest, like I missed the team aspects. I love building teams.
How long was it from, in quotes, Anne's retirement?
Yeah.
To...
Not that long. Yeah, a couple of years.
So a couple of years from Zendesk to then, right?
Yeah.
And in those couple of years, how long did it take before you were like, huh, let's be honest. Did it take Asana to then say, oh, I want to work again? Or was that itch not slowly building over that break?
It had been. I think I had spent some time with an earlier stage company, Guru. So it had, I had been thinking about like, oh, I miss sort of like the building a team. And I love the part of helping people realize their potential and their career ambitions. Like those are some of the most rewarding things of just people that have been part of my teams in the past that are now running their own businesses or GMs of big divisions or started a company or any of the things. Like it's probably the most rewarding things when I connect with people and just get to see all the incredible things that they are now doing. So that's always a part that I miss when I'm not directly, you know, responsible for a team. And then I think some of with Asana was like for the right company at the right scale and size where there's a ton of growth ahead and it's a time of evolution. I think that I was very excited and passionate about.
You've sat or sit on many boards. You've worked closely with many founders. What's the toughest feedback that you've ever had to give? You don't have to, you can anonymize who it was to.
Yeah.
But I would love to know the feedback.
Yes. I will say the category of feedback that's always the hardest to give, but the most important, especially in a board capacity, is around the team around the founder. I would say it's less about, in terms of like delivering that feedback, especially as a board member, it's more about, am I asking the right questions? Am I encouraging the founder to think about the choices they are making and the potential consequences of those choices? Am I helping them think through the decisions versus, you know, it's not my job to be prescriptive, but it is my job to ask the important questions so that they can think through and be in a position to make good decisions, that they understand what the consequences might be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Can you give me an example? Like, have you flat out told a founder you need to fire your XYZ?
I have not, because I have found that with founders, if you say it that way, there's often resistance to that. Because as a board member, you've got to remember, we're also only seeing part of the story. We're seeing what the founder and the management team are telling us in different moments. Like we're not on the ground every day. So it is our responsibility to ask good questions, not just of the founder, but spending time with their management team, spending time in between board meetings and staying curious about what might actually be happening and the root causes. And then it's the job of a board. Well, I feel like it, and other people may disagree, which is like a good topic, but I feel like my role is not to say, hey, this person on your team is a problem. You need to fire them. I think my responsibility is to ask questions like, okay, based on what the ambitions of the company are, based on what we're trying to achieve, when you fast forward a year, 2 years, and you picture what you need around you, do you have the people around you? In this particular function, do you see this person succeeding? If not, why not? Is that something that's coachable? Is it an experience gap? Is it a will gap? Are there other possibilities of how to shore up that experience? By asking questions that way, they're generative. It gives the very brilliant founder the opportunity to consider all of that and have agency in making that decision. Going straight to like, you should fire that person. If I'm prescriptive, it's one choice. When there's actually, in almost every situation, there's a set of options to consider. Mm. It's not binary. And in fact, that's the muscle we would want anybody to build, especially founders where it's the first time they're managing as big a team or as experienced a set of people around them.
I didn't know this, but I also didn't know there was a work innovation lab at Asana. Is that
a
thing? I didn't know that
is.
Was a thing, which
yes.
I'd love to hear about. But did you also do, the first I've ever heard of it was Shopify doing the meeting, the cancel recurring meetings?
Oh, yeah.
Did you all do that too?
So the lab did research on how to help teams and companies really make sure they're spending their time intentionally.
Uh-huh.
And so one of the interventions is deleting all your meetings and then starting.
All recurring meetings.
All recurring meetings. Yeah. So we haven't done that across the whole company, but we encourage teams in particular and departments that are feeling like, hey, we're spending more time in meetings to actually embrace the what happens if you sort of blow up all the meetings and then really only put the ones back on, as well as I think there's a really important thing of resisting recurring or setting a finite time frame for a recurring. Because recurring meetings can just build up and then they're just like a thing that's on your calendar and you do it because it's recurring and then more recurring meetings get added up and then you're spending all your time shuffling all your recurring meetings. I think a good habit is like, okay, maybe we do need this meeting for a period of time, but then decide we're only going to allow it to be a recurring meeting for 2 months. And then if we actually still need it, we can set it up again. And that's also freeing too, to make that choice.
This includes one-on-ones?
Yeah, I actually am a big believer of like, there are one-on-ones that you should have more regularly, especially when you're building a relationship. And then even trying things where you switch up shorter one-on-ones versus longer one-on-ones. And then just asking like, is this still time well spent or not? Because with some relationships, you know the person well enough and you're actually talking all the time or texting or calling all the time in between a one-on-one. So you don't actually need that time. I find that on my team, there's like different people with different styles. And so we communicate and interact and make decisions in different ways. And I actually enjoy that. Like, am I adapting my leadership style and my management to be the best fit for this person and what they need? Yeah. I'd encourage people to experiment with it.
Yeah. I'm relieved to hear that. My team gives me a hard time all the time because I don't do one-on-ones because I'm like, we're talking every day.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to save this piece of information that we had that came up on Thursday for our next one-on-one on Wednesday? Anyway, I appreciate you doing this.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you inviting me. I also now I'm like, why was I so hard to schedule? I need to work on that.
You're ruminating on that?
Yeah, I am.
I didn't mean it in a tough way. You're one of the good people in tech and, we need more of them. So I just appreciate it.
That is the kindest thing you could say. Thank you.
Are you hiring?
We are.
Are there any roles that...
We are building out our go-to-market team. So certainly we're looking for great AEs who want to join. We have a phenomenal CRO on board and he's just making things happen. And so I'd encourage anybody who is looking for a high impact sales career to reach out to us. And then we're hiring across the board in go-to-market. So if people are interested in learning more about Asana, I would love to chat with them about it.
When you hear the word grit, what do you think of or who do you think of?
When I think of the word grit, I actually think about my maternal grandmother. So she had to bring 4 of her kids who were under the age of 5 out of a war-torn country to Taiwan. My grandfather was in the Nationalist Army that had to leave China, and he traveled separately. He was bringing his mother and my uncle, who had a childhood injury and so required sort of extra care in moving out of a war-torn country. And so my grandfather brought my great-grandmother and my uncle And so that left my grandmother with four children that she had to move herself with the things that she could carry out of a country and get them on a train, on a boat, and sort of leaving her family and everything she knew behind. And she was just always like the most positive, delightful, strong, happy person you could ever meet. She was just like the person that like, it's like light in a room, made everybody feel good. And until I was older and understood her story and what she had to do to really protect her family. And that's grit. You know, like there's days when it's like, oh yeah, my job is hard. Things I'm doing are hard. I didn't have to carry my kids out of a war-torn country. And so there's courage and strength in so many forms, remembering the privilege that some of us have, myself included, because my grandmother had grit. That to me is what grit means.
What a nice way to end it. Anne, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. This was such a lovely conversation.
Thank you. That's it. Thanks for tuning in. Feel free to come back every Monday morning to listen to a new guest or go back into the archives when we've done more than 100 episodes. This podcast is a Kleiner Perkins production, and the episode was edited by Eric Johnson from Lightning Pod. Thank you all.